Ugh, another naked pic request.
Why doesn't he stop?
I know, he just keeps on and on and on. Maybe I should just send him one?
No way!
He said I could trust him.
Heard that before.
Look what happened to, what's her name? Some guy shared her pic and it broke the internet. Everyone saw it. Her parents, her teachers. Poor girl.
He's getting well desperate.
Ugh, forget him.
No one should be pressured into sending a naked picture. To find out more, search Disrespect Nobody.
Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello, I'm Tristan Riddell.
And I'm Matt Hansen.
And you're listening to the Nerd Party.
Talk nerdy to me.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Thank you so much for joining. If you listened to the episode last week and you listened all the way to the end, and we recommend that you do because we always give a brief preview of what we're going to do the next week. And if you listened, you would have gotten a cartoon version of a possible ending to the movie Aliens. And that is what we're doing this week, is we're doing a retrospective of the entire Alien franchise. Well, more of a focus on the quadrilogy, as you would call it, because you and I, Matt, are big fans of the Alien movies and not necessarily the Alien versus Predator movies.
You asked if we were going to do the Alien versus Predator, and I said I'm never watching those movies again, then yes, I agree.
And Matt is a big stickler for research, and so if he's not going to watch it again, he doesn't want to talk about it. You know, you and I are friends, and one of the pillars of our friendship is our shared interest, and a big portion of said pillar is the Alien franchise. And you actually, for my birthday, you bought me an Alien novel.
Because this is the 35th, this year, 2014, is the 35th anniversary of the original film. I guess they decided to release a trilogy of books associated with Alien. And the first book that I had read was called Out of the Shadows, and it takes place between Alien and Aliens, and it features a story about Ripley. And I was really intrigued because, as far as we know, and we'll get into it, Ripley never was awoken between Alien and Aliens. So how could there be a story? So I read this book, really enjoyed it, and so, yeah, I sent it along to you for your birthday this year.
Yeah, and that is much appreciated. And I, the Alien franchise, before we get into it, the Alien franchise is just filled with some of the best directors working today. And the first one, as we all know, was directed by Ridley Scott. Aliens was directed by, you know, our man, James Cameron. And the third one is one of my favorite directors of all time, David Fincher. And then you have some random French guy.
Actually, not just random French guy. He is a well-known French filmmaker. I've seen other films in his oeuvre before. Jean-Pierre Jeunet.
I know. I'm just giving you a hard time because I know we have certain disagreements when it comes to Alien Resurrection. But that's a little tease for the rest of the episode, but as we've kind of grown accustomed to doing before we start the episode, we like to talk about some movies that we've seen on our own time individually, and one movie that I literally just saw, I got back from the movie theater this second, and what you saw a couple of days ago, and speaking of David Fincher, we saw his latest picture, Gone Girl.
Yeah, I saw that last week on opening week, and actually opening day in a pretty much packed theater here in Tucson.
So let's try to stay away from the spoilers. What were some of your favorite things about the movie?
Well, let me just put it this way. Ben Affleck is obviously touted as lead of this film, but I want to give special attention to Rosamund Pike, because prior to this movie, the thing I know her best from is she's Miranda Frost from Die Another Day. And
that was the first time I saw her, too.
I'll just say this much. After watching her in this film, I will no longer picture her as just Miranda Frost.
Yeah, she was definitely a delight of this movie. She definitely stole, even though Ben Affleck's name was first on the letterhead, she definitely stole the movie from everybody else.
I would even venture to say it's more her movie than even Ben Affleck's. I mean, I know Ben Affleck's a big part of the film, but I would even say she's the star.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's kind of like with his last film, The Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. Now, you know, obviously, Daniel Craig's name holds more weight than Rooney Mara, and it's the same with Ben Affleck. But the thing is, that is very much Lisbeth's movie.
Right.
In The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And so, like, it is very much her movie, even though, you know, she's second on the billing. Also, one thing that I really kind of want to talk to you about, and I hopefully we can do this without giving spoilers, and if we do, I'll cut it out. But I tried to stay away from as much advertising about this and as much reviews about this before I could see it. And one thing that I couldn't help but notice every single time an article would pop up on Twitter or Tumblr was that a lot of people were saying, this is the most feminist movie that's in mainstream theaters today. People who haven't seen it yet, I ask you that question. How is this a feminist film? And in your opinion, because I think feminism is good, I think it's definitely needed in today's cinema, in today's workforce, in today's society. And so I'm asking you as a viewer, watch this movie and try to tell me, how on earth is this a feminist movie?
That's all that I'm going to challenge the viewer. Now,
a lot of the same people that David Fincher uses came out for this film, i.e. the music as well as editing. Now, you have Atticus Ross and Trent Reznor, who did the music, and I thought it was a much more understated soundtrack than what we previously get. And editing, we got Kirk Baxter, but no Angus Wall, which I think was definitely noticeable in the film.
Well, I gotta say, I know this is a very minor portion of the film, but at the very beginning, the way that the opening sequences were edited kind of threw me off, because they're quick cuts, they're flashes, even the crew's name just flashes on the screen, and then at first I was like, is the projector broken? Like, is it, yeah. Like, but I really liked the way that was filmed, and it was very interesting, and I liked the fact that because you have Trent and Reznor involved in this soundtrack, there is no... There's no orchestral score as you would think of it in a classic Hollywood film. All the music in this film, I would say, is very atmospheric, and it just underlines a scene rather than permeates it.
Yes, very much so. There was a few times, about like three or four times, when the music became very prevalent on purpose, and it was very heavy-hitting, and then smash cut to complete silence, where it would just build, and no falling music or falling notes or anything like that. It was just build, cut. And I thought that was very interesting, and it was very, very similar to The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, but much more understated. And the editing, I noticed the thing about the editing as well at the very beginning, where the names flashed up very fast. It, like, flash, fade down, flash, fade down. And I was like, was this on purpose? This had to have been on purpose, because you could barely read the names. I was like, what is the reason behind this?
And I'm guessing it's because, you know, this film is about a vanishing. So the credits are literally appearing and vanishing before you.
I think that's as good a reason as any. I think that's pretty good.
Now, I have to say, there are twists in this movie, but this film, there's actually a major twist. And we're not going to spoil what that is. What I'm going to ask you, Tristan, is I started picking up on clues right away. Like, I started paying attention to specifically what characters were saying and how they were reacting to certain lines being said. And I kind of put it together as the movie was about to reveal it. Now, did you have any inkling about what the reveal was going to be about halfway through the film?
I knew exactly what was going on. Just from, I'm not trying to, like, boost my own ego, and I'm not trying to, like, say, like, oh, you can't fool me, but I pretty much knew exactly what the movie was going to be about and how it was thrown about, even just from the trailer. Like, I knew what was going to be going on.
See, but I don't know whether that makes me more naive or not, but the trailer had me thinking the way that the movie wanted me to think. And then knowing that there was some sort of twist, I've not read the book, and I purposely stayed away from all, like, reviews and material regarding this film, other than the fact that I knew it was being reviewed positively.
Well, one cool thing about the movie that is that the author of the novel, Gillian Flynn, was also the author of the screenplay, and she rewrote the third act of the movie to be completely different from the novel. And I haven't read the novel yet, and so I cannot wait to read the book to figure out what the difference is.
Right. From what I heard, it's, for the most part, it's mostly the same film, so I'm curious to find out the differences, too. All in all, without spoiling too much about this film, I really enjoyed it. I think Fincher still got something to him. I may not speak too highly of Alien 3 later during our discussion, but I don't think that's necessarily his fault, given the production history behind it. I'm more... On that one, I'm more... not with the story so much. But he's definitely got a style to him, and I've been a fan of his since... Not since Alien 3, but since 7. 7 is actually my favorite Fincher film, and it would be, considering my taste in cinema.
Yeah, Fincher is one of my top two directors of all time, if not the top, and I'll watch anything that he does. And I right now, like, even though I have to digest his movies, I have to think about them, I have to ponder them, and walking away from this, my gut reaction is that was a solid film. It was very well made, very well done, acted superbly. It is by far not my favorite Fincher film. It's probably not even in the top three, but it's something that I definitely want to watch again, and I think I will probably enjoy even more the next time I see it.
It's hard for me to say, because I'm kind of, you know, influenced by the recency effect, but I really liked this film. I definitely recommend it. I honestly think, Tristan, if we don't do a Fincher retrospective anytime soon, I think that we're going to be able to talk about this come Oscar season, because I could see this getting some awards buzz later.
I think so too, especially for the performances. And Ben Affleck did a solid job, and I'm not a big fan of his acting. I'm a big fan of his direction, but he did a solid job. And this is straight off the hot off the presses. Matt, I just got a text from my wife, the girl here, and it says, "I just read that there's only dialogue differences between movie and book. The same outcome happens. It was a ploy to get people to come and watch it." That sucks. That pisses me off.
But come on, it worked, doesn't it? I mean, like, I love theater tactics like this. It dates back to me all the way to where Alfred Hitchcock wouldn't let anybody come in after Psycho started. You know, it's just one of those things that gets people talking and gets people interested, and I kind of like that. I mean, I think that's missing from a lot of movies these days, so that doesn't bother me so much. And as far as Ben Affleck's concerned, I was kind of impressed by him, I have to say. Does he give the best performance of his career? Probably not, but I really, really liked the way he faced the challenges that his character did in this film.
Yeah, it's very good performances. And to kind of go back to what you were saying about missing that in theater and like changing the outcomes and lying, to speak of Fincher again, at the beginning of season two of House of Cards, before season two of House of Cards, which is executive produced by Fincher, is we see footage of one of the main characters being a TV news reporter and being on air and being with a news truck, which we've never seen her do before. And we're like, oh, cool. Zoe's going to be a news reporter this season. And we see none of that in the first episode. And then bam, the character dies. And you're like, oh, holy crap. They completely lied to us in the promotional material, thinking that she's going to be a part of season two. And she was just in the first episode of season two. It's kind of like with Scream.
Yeah.
And Drew Barrymore.
Yes. But the thing is, I think those things become a problem when lying becomes a problem is when, in your opinion or in audience's opinion, the rest of the movie or TV show doesn't hold up. If you still got a good movie around the quote unquote lie, I think you're good to go.
I think you're right. I think you're very right. If you lie to people to get people in the seats, like I'd say the Hercules movie with The Rock. That was a completely mismarket on purpose to get you in the seats, and then they tricked you into seeing a crappy movie.
Right.
Where this was not a story about Hercules. Like, all that cool and fantastic footage that you see of him fighting monsters and demons and going through the seven trials, like, that was all spread throughout the trailer. That was actually in the first couple of minutes of the movie of a guy telling a tall tale.
Right.
To pump up Hercules, and then all of a sudden you just have this mindless action film that follows that has nothing to do with the gods or the trials or Olympus or anything like that. That's when it goes too far.
Right, but in the case that you mentioned earlier where I was old enough to remember all those trailers and TV promotions for the original Scream, and yeah, all those ones said that, yes, Drew Barrymore is clearly the star of this film. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because the rest of the film is so good, That trick works phenomenally.
Well, one piece of marketing promotions that was spot on about how you would feel if you purchased this title is Alien Isolation.
Okay,
and I picked that up.
I'm so curious to ask you what your experiences were, because from what I've been reading now, there's a lot of positive buzz surrounding this game, more so than any other Alien game that's been released in the past decade, I would say. So, but you are notoriously difficult to please. So, so I'm curious to get your impressions of this.
So far I love it. I've only played for a couple of hours. I played one or two hours with the first day that I got it, and I played 1 hour just yesterday. And since I knew we were going to be talking about it on this podcast, I played a little bit of the campaign, and I also played a little bit of the Nostromo level, which I pre-ordered it through GameStop so that I would get the Nostromo edition, and that way I could play as Ripley or Dallas or, you know, I can't remember who else. And so in the main campaign, you play Ellen Ripley's daughter,
mm-hmm.
and they find the black box from the Nostromo, and it's on some space station somewhere. So her and a couple of other people go to the space station. But the thing is, the space station's run down. Like, something happened where it was closed, or it was on its way out, and they lost their funding, and so they were going to close the space station. But then that's when the alien hit. And I don't know how we don't know how the alien got on there yet, but everything's weird. It's like this post-apocalyptic space station where, like, stuff's written on the walls like, leave, forgive us, or, you know, like weird stuff like that, where it's all run down, and it's kind of like a you know, every man for himself kind of situation. It's not something that you would normally see in a space station. It's like, I don't know, it's kind of like if Road Warrior meets Deep Space Nine, that kind of thing.
Or, you know, to me that just sounds like they're taking elements from other movies as well, because that just sounds to me like when the Marines show up in Aliens and find the whole Colonial Operations Center abandoned, torn apart, stuff is leaking, people are gone. I mean, I've seen footage. It's not quite as bloody as it is in the game, but yeah. To me, it has that sort of air to it.
It's definitely has that feeling to it. I'm glad that you brought that up, because it has that Aliens, you know, colony feel to it, where everything's gone wrong, but it has people in it that you have to be wary of. You have to avoid these people because they're psychos and they'll kill you because they think that you're there to kill them, and everybody's scavenging for food and trying to find their way out. And I just got to a part where the person I was with gets killed by the alien in a very gnarly way. And I started playing the Nostromo edition, and so I'm Ripley, and you have to just little missions that you have to go around the ship. Like, okay, you have to seal the hatch on either ends of the ship, then you have to go and enter this code into the computer. You have to go through the ducts. You have the flamethrower, and you can't kill the alien, but you can scare it off with the fire. And you die so many times. Like, I only died once or twice when I was playing the main campaign, but I died constantly in the Nostromo edition. And you don't have a gun. At least I don't have a gun yet, and in the main campaign, and you definitely don't in the Nostromo edition. But they find a way to make it entertaining without having a gun. So it's this feeling of a first-person shooter without the shooter portion. And somebody was trying to, you know, have me explain it. It's not like a role-playing game, and it's not like a first-person shooter. It's not exactly a puzzle game either. It's very cool
to me. I mean, because I've seen gameplay footage, and it's very creepy. Like, it almost reminds me of the same feeling I get when I go back and watch the original film. That my favorite film in the series is Aliens, and we'll get to that when we get to the discussion. But I forget sometimes how scary that first film is. And when I watched this footage, it was legitimately frightening. Like, I jumped a few times. The way I would classify this game is it's more of a survivalist sort of game.
Yeah. Yes. That's the word I was looking for. It is a survivalist game. That is what it is. It's a survivalist game. You have to be sneaky, you have to be slow, and you have to be deliberate. And so it's not everybody's game. I cannot say that everybody should buy this, because it's very specific to its audience, and it's very specific to its feel and its authenticity. And you have to be slow. You have to use your head. You cannot just jump into a room and start, you know, like shooting up the place. It just doesn't work that way. And I jumped twice, like during the main campaign. I had that feeling in your chest, you know, like when you get a when you have a real scare. All it wasn't even the alien; it was just like a light drop from the ceiling and started.
And they do
teetering.
That on purpose just to throw you off. And I have to say, it's important to understand that this is the first game I think ever or in a long time that's specifically marketed under Alien and not Aliens. And I think that from the footage that I've seen, it is very much in keeping with the atmosphere of that first film, where you have no idea where it is. You just know it's in with you somewhere. And it may come out at any point.
And that was my second scare was it was very much like the first film, like in that scene where Dallas is in the vents and he turns to the left and he can see the alien because he has his flamethrower lit, and the alien just kind of reaches out its arms and then it cuts. That happened to me where I was sitting with my wife, and she likes to watch me play certain video games, like the more cinematic ones, like Arkham Origins or Arkham City. And Alien, and because she's a big Alien fan too. And so I was in the vents and I was checking out, I paused it so I could check out the map. I was like, okay, so I need to go straight and take a left here so I can get to where I need to go. And so I unpaused the game and immediately turned left, and there it is. And I jumped and screamed, and my wife could not stop laughing at me because it was such a genuine reaction that I had.
I can't wait till we get to the discussion of that first movie, Tristan, because to me, it's hard to narrow down what my favorite scare is in that first movie, but the first time I watched it, I think it was that moment with Dallas and the air vent that was the moment that made me jump the most.
Well, let's go right into it. Let's talk about Alien 1979, directed by Ridley Scott, starring Tom Skerritt, Sigourney Weaver, Veronica Cartwright, Harry Dean Stanton, John Hurt, Ian Holm, and Yaphet Kotto. This was an amazing film. When was the first time that you watched it?
I watched it. I think it was one of the first horror films that my parents let me watch when I was 12, or it had to be 11 or 12. And I rented it knowing kind of what I was walking into, and I really, really was impressed. It became one of my favorite films, and I think I went back either the next day or the next week or whenever my mom would let me rent again so I could see Aliens.
The first time I saw this was there was an Alien marathon on TV, because I did not watch this early on. I did not watch this when I was very young. I watched it when I was young, but not when I was very young. And I missed Alien in this marathon, and all I got to watch was Aliens and Alien 3. I think this was before Alien. This was actually well before Alien Resurrection came out, and I was kind of ticked. I was like, "Dang it, I missed the first one. How, you know, I need to go back and watch the first one." So I went out and rented it, and it was on old VHS, and it was just absolutely amazing. I fell in love with it, and this was kind of my first. This was the beginning of my love affair with Ridley Scott, who would later on become my boss. And it was just fantastic to everything about it, the artwork and set design and alien design, and especially from H.R. Giger, and it just the editing, the music from Jerry Goldsmith, who we know very well from Star Trek. And there was just, I just can't think of a weak link in this movie.
No, I can't think of one either. And I gotta say, have you watched any of the behind-the-scenes making of any of these films? Because I gotta tell you, in 2003, they came out with the DVD quadrilogy set, and it was the same. They put the same features on the Blu-ray set that came out, I think, a few years ago. And I've purposely sat down and watched all of those. First, when I got the original set, but I watched them again recently so I could have this in mind, and I just love the way that this film came together and how it was a deliberate decision later in the casting process to make the Ripley character a woman.
I watched as much of the behind the scenes stuff that I could, and because just last Christmas my wife got me that big Blu-ray set, like the definitive collection or whatever it was called, and where it had both versions of every film, because I think every film has had a director's cut or an unrated cut or an extended cut. And so all four movies has two editions. It has tons and tons of behind the scenes footage, as you said. It was cool to see how the casting process happened and why it was necessary to have a female lead, where at first you don't know it's going to be a female lead. You don't know that this is going to be Ripley's movie. You have no idea that she's going to be the last person alive until we go further on.
And let's not forget, you know, Sigourney Weaver wasn't a name yet. In fact, this is the film that made her. I believe her only film credit up to this point was she had a cameo at the end of Annie Hall a couple of years back from this point. And she noticed, too, she's not the first name that comes up. Tom Skerritt is the first name that comes up. So for a majority of this film, you think Captain Dallas is the hero.
And Tom Skerritt's amazing in this movie. I mean, Tom Skerritt is pretty much Tom Skerritt in whatever movie he does or whatever TV show he's in. But this was, like, he was such a cool captain because I would want to work for this captain. I'd be like, yeah, that's my captain. Like, he's rough and tumble. He gets stuff done. And, like, he has that leadership quality, and I just love the passing of the torch within the movie to Sigourney Weaver, where you realize that something's special about her, and we start focusing on her more and more as more and more people get picked off. And this is, you know, this is 1979 people. This is, you know, like, you think we don't get a lot of female protagonists today. Just think about back then.
Oh, yeah, it was unheard of, and that's part of the reason why I think they decided to go with it, because it's never been done. So it would get people talking.
You know, they said that they wanted the crew to have kind of interchangeable gender roles, where it's not just, like, the engineers aren't men because they're men. It's just they just happen to be men who are engineers, and you have the captain is a captain not because he's a man, but just because he's good at what he does, and Ripley's not the, you know, like the take no crap from nobody because she's a woman. It's just because that's who she is. And so they tried to focus on making these parts, I think what I read was unisex. Like, it doesn't matter what gender they were. And I think they wanted to go for truckers in space.
Yeah.
And which is really, that feels more like James Cameron than Ridley Scott to me.
It does, but when we get to Aliens, I would argue there's a lot of James Cameron in that film. But
oh yeah, absolutely.
But as far as, yeah, space truckers is the motif they were going for. And I would say that, yeah, I knew that they were described as unisex characters. But once you assign the genders that they assign to them, it makes their dynamic very interesting. Because I'm thinking specifically of the way, you know, Ripley interacted with most of the crew. You have that great scene near the beginning where Parker and Brett really don't think that much of her, and she has that scene in the hallway with them where she's like, yeah, you'll get whatever's coming to you, and, you know, why don't you just F off? And, you know, they don't really think of her as that much of a threat. And I like how that progresses through the movie, and it's finally, you know, when Parker, well, when she's in command, that first scene where she's actually in command and Parker just won't take no for an answer, and she actually says, would you listen to me, Parker, shut up. And, you know,
yeah.
I like how he's kind of the character that forces her into a more authoritarian position.
I like the age range of the people in the cast, because you had a lot of people who, and Roger Ebert talked about this, and I have a very special connection to Roger Ebert because he's from my hometown, and we freaking love him there. And he was talking about how a lot of the people were older than what you would get in a typical thriller at that time. And you have people in their early 50s and late 40s. And then you had Weaver at, I think, age 29 or something like that, which that was the usual, you know, age range, if not younger. And so I'm always a big fan of people in these age range in movies, because you have so many movies that are marketed towards young people that they try to skew younger with the actors and actresses in the film. So it was nice to see people who you would believe would be an engineer or a captain or a space trucker. You know, like, it was an age. It wasn't like some hot 19-year-old guy who, you know, looked good in a t-shirt. You know, it was something authentic.
Right. So, yeah, if this movie were to be rebooted today under Hollywood standards, we would get, you know, Megan Fox's Ripley.
Right, exactly. We would get that kind of BS. And before I just go on and on about that, the Blu-rays are so impressive. People people at home, if I'm an HD nut, I am a pixel nut. These movies are so well done with the transfer, so meticulously restored, and just fantastic. It looks like it could have been made today. In the filming, they did a majority of the filming in late 1978, and they did so much cool stuff with fiberglass and molds and casts, and the models, I miss models so much because it just gives something tangible and real towards special effects. And this did it so well because these ships, the Nostromo on Blu-ray, looks better than anything that you saw in Prometheus with CGI.
Agreed. You actually feel the scale of models. And while I think you can, if with good CGI, you can capture some of that, you can't really capture all of it. Now, question I want to pose to you, because each of these films is kind of a different genre of film, and this one is very much a haunted house horror film, I would say. Mm-hmm. Biggest scare for you in the film? Because there are many.
I'd say the biggest scare, the absolute biggest scare, was at the very end, where Sigourney's in the escape pod, or the lifeboat, whatever you want to call it, and she's getting out of her suit and she's getting out of her clothes and she's just in that little tank top and those oddly misfitting panties.
You're gonna talk about the claw, aren't you?
You see the xenomorph's head, like what Ridley Scott did was he made you look at the xenomorph's head for a good 15 seconds. Before you realize what it was.
And let's give credit to not only Ridley Scott, but H.R. Giger for not only designing the alien, but designing the infrastructure and all that sort of stuff, where there are parts of the Nostromo and parts of the shuttle in that scene that look, there are other parts of the shuttle that look like the alien head as well. And it blends right into all the infrastructure.
Absolutely. Yeah. Before we go into aliens, we're definitely going to be talking about H.R. Giger and the genius that was behind the alien design. But yeah, that was my biggest scare, is that the camera's on Ripley and the camera's on the xenomorph before you even know it. It's kind of like in The Shining when you're in the it's the old lady scene where like Jack goes into the hotel room that he's not supposed to. And you're looking at the shower and the woman's there, but you have no idea she's there until she moves. It's the exact same situation with the xenomorph. And then that sting from Goldsmith. And you're just like, oh, God, it was there the entire time. I was staring at his head. That was definitely my biggest scare. How about you?
And you know what? I'm happy to report, because I've actually had the privilege of seeing this. There's an indie cinema house here in Tucson that every Friday and Saturday, each week they'll rerun a different cult classic. And I've gotten to see Alien projected on a big screen with an audience a couple times here. And that moment still works. It gets people. People scream in the theater. And the nice thing is, both times I had people who had never seen the movie before in the audience with me. So
yeah, that's great. I love feeling that. Like, it's like watching it again for the first time when you are with somebody who's watching it for the first time.
I've got two, three. I'll narrow it down to three because I can't do one. One is the claw. That definitely got me when I was 12. Second one is Dallas in the air ducts, and that's the first time I think that I noticed the specific use of music and sound and lighting in a film to really create a sense of horror and dread.
And alien jazz hands.
Yeah, alien jazz hands. If you listen to the commentary that the cast recorded on the film, Tom Skerritt is on there, and when that scene comes up, he says, "Oh look, it looks like he's singing me a ballad."
It is like, it's a scary moment, but then once you've seen it a couple of times, you realize that they might have held on that shot maybe just a second too long.
So I mean, I know what you're trying to say, but like I said, having seen that in a theater, it still got people. So. That's how I can tell that it works.
Well, it definitely works, and I'm not saying it doesn't, but it's just from a retrospective, you're just kind of like, and the alien's not even lunging towards him, he's just kind of reaching out his hands and shaking him.
And the third one has nothing even to do with the alien, but it has to do with you're so on edge because any sound could be the alien coming through, and it's that cat scare that's at the near the end when Ripley's trying to find the cat, and it jumps out, and she screams, and she's like, Jones, damn it.
I knew it was going to be something involving the cat, because there's two scenes in the movie where the cat just jumps out and you're like, oh jeez.
But that first one, I know when it's coming. That second one, I never remember what point in the film the cat jumps out, so it always gets me.
Well, you talked about H.R. Giger, and sadly, he is no longer with us. But his work will live on forever because it is genius. He's a surrealist, and he's dark, and he's morbid, and visceral, and it's, some would say, erotic. And like he blends a lot of feminine traits with disturbing imagery, disturbing, very, and I, this is no pun intended, very alien type energy, something that we are not familiar with. And Geiger, like his work on Alien, the movie, is very much inspired by his work called Necronom 4, which when you see this, like, just go ahead and Google it, Necronom 4. It's, you can tell that that was kind of like the genesis of what we see now as the Xenomorph. And as you talked about how he was very much in charge of certain parts of the set design, and the space jockey, which we see in the movie and also in Prometheus, he airbrushed by hand the entire set to give it this authentic and just realistic feel. And one thing that I love about that scene, too, with the space jockey is that they use children to make it look even bigger.
Right.
Children in spacesuits.
And I like how I never picked up on this when I watched it the first time, but I watched it subsequent times with the dialogue in that scene. There's so much information that's being presented in that scene, specifically when they said, looks like his ribs are, they look at the space jockey and there's a hole in him. And it they say that it looks like he exploded from the inside. And I never caught that the first time, but it obviously becomes incredibly important later to what is probably, when people say the Alien or think of Alien, they think of the scene with John Hurt.
Yes. Yeah. That has to be the most infamous scene of the movie. And it's been parodied so many times. And rightly so. It's a fantastic scene. It's iconic.
And I just want to nip something in the bud right away, because there's a lot of differing stories about how this scene was shot. There's an urban legend out there that said that the actors had no idea what was going to happen. I've seen multiple interviews with Sigourney Weaver and the rest of the cast. They knew what the scene would entail. They just didn't know how it was going to look. So they always talk about, oh, they didn't know what was going to happen, and the look of surprise on their faces is because they didn't know what was going to happen. No, they knew what was in the script, but they didn't know how it was going to look when it all played out, and that's where the shock of the scene comes from.
And also, I mean, so many people who don't know how movies are made, there is so much preparation that goes into every single shot. Not just every single scene, every single shot. And there's no way that they could have prepped John Hurt's body without them knowing at least what might happen.
Not only that, but when the alien pops out of him and scurries off, which is a great little scare, they shot that by having the thing was attached to a string, and someone was underneath the table on a skateboard, and they pushed the thing out, and that's what makes it scurry off. They had one shot at that, so it had to be perfectly set up and planned.
Yeah, exactly. And so, it for some reason, it always kind of reminds me of, not this doesn't always remind me, but this just made me think of it. In Django Unchained, there was a scene where Leonardo DiCaprio slams his hand down on the table and cuts himself on a piece of glass. And instead of stopping, he just goes with it. He just goes with it, and his hand's bleeding, and he tries to wrap it up. And it's genius. It's awesome. It looks great on film, and he knew that it was going to look great. And then in the next shot, he smears his hand on the actress's face, so she has blood all over her face. Now, the story got out that he didn't know that it was unintended that he was going to cut his hand, and so it was real. And it said that her reactions were real because it was unplanned, and he didn't say that he was going to rub blood on her face. No way in hell is that even remotely true, because there's just no way that any decent human being would rub their blood on another person's face, and nor would she just sit there. What happened was, and if you look, if they change the shot, the angle changes at least by 30%. And that takes sometimes hours to change a camera angle like that on a professional movie set. And so what happened was they wrapped up his hand and they cleaned it up. And then Quentin Tarantino said, okay, let's just go with it. Let's just say you have to do this. And so they put fake blood on her face. The accidents do happen in movies, and sometimes the actors just go with it. But there are also other times when the audience needs to go, okay, this is fake. Movies are fake, and it takes a lot of time to prepare them. Let's just be smart about these things.
Plus, I mean, just the logistics of it. I mean, the actors have to know what's coming up or what the lines that they have to say are. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you can't keep that sort of stuff from them. Otherwise, it's just improv, and not a lot of movies are shot on improv.
Yeah, exactly. Like, a lot of comedies are improv, and sometimes you can do, like, a line or two here and there when you're doing a drama or an action film. But for the most part, 99% of a movie is very much planned.
And for this specific scene, the chestburster scene, there's no way that could have not been planned because it's so meticulous.
Whenever you do a special effect, you're talking about hours, weeks, months of planning. Now, we need to move on. Now, it's hard not to just completely talk about this movie on its own because there's so many great things about this, and there's so much behind the scenes stuff that we could talk about. But we need to move on. So this obviously did very well. It had a budget of an estimated $11 million and went on to make, I think, $100 million domestically and $200 million worldwide or something like that. That's not a bad return on your investment. And because it did so well, they went on and they're like, how can we go bigger? What do we need to do? Well, instead of just one alien, let's do a movie with a whole bunch of them. And thus came Aliens, plural.
Well, actually, it took a long time because you may not realize this, or people may not realize this, but it's a good 7 years between Alien and Aliens. So,
came out the same time I was born, same month.
So it's kind of interesting that you would think in this day and age, if Alien came out today and was a hit, we'd have a sequel in probably 2 years, tops, because we want to capitalize on that right away. The fact that it took 7 years was fascinating to me, and what they came up with was equally as fascinating, because what Aliens represents is it's still a horror film, but it's a shifting of genre, which I think the Alien series does very well.
I think so too. Like, this is a very different film. This is a lot of times you will see in an intellectual property or a franchise where there's a common thread. Like, we were just a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about the Before Sunrise series. That's all very much the same film. It's all the same style, feeling, very similar. Now, obviously, we're talking about apples and oranges with the Alien film, but like when you have like the Dark Knight trilogy, the feeling is very much the same with Batman Begins, Dark Knight, and Dark Knight Rises. Now, granted, there is some artistic differences here and there between Batman Begins and Dark Knight, but it's all very much the same kind of thread. With Alien and Aliens, these are two very different movies, and you yourself have stated very succinctly, which you very often do, is Alien is a horror film, and Aliens is an action film.
An action film, specifically a war film, and it has so many themes, and I think James Cameron kind of made some of them deliberate. It has themes of Vietnam in the sense that it's a story about people who are going to face an enemy that are so hopelessly outmatched, and they don't even realize it when they're going in.
Yes, very much. And I love the intrigue of the first one. I love the aesthetic. I love the ambiance. And in this one, this is a good movie. This is a very good film, but it is not exactly my type of sci-fi film. Like, my type of sci-fi film is Alien. Like, bam, there. Little bit of action, much more intrigue, much more how are we going to get out of this and how are we going to survive. And with Aliens, it's how big can our guns be? And that's not a criticism. That's not a criticism at all. I just feel like that we're talking about two great movies on opposite ends of the spectrum.
But I think there's a way to enjoy both, because I do enjoy both. Yes, I tend to go with Aliens more, but it has nothing really to do with the more action-oriented nature of the genre. I think I just like the idea. I think sequels can be interesting, especially these kind of horror sequels, because you're building on things that were already established. Like, I always like first entries in a series, but I like second entries, I think, can be even more intriguing, because where do you take the characters from here? And I think what drew me in more to Aliens is seeing how Ripley is dealing with the trauma from the first film, which is pretty much the first half hour of this film. is just dealing with what's going on and seeing her nightmares and seeing her being forced to go back to this colony, and I like seeing that. And I'm not ashamed to admit it, I really, really like the cast of Alien, but I love the cast of Aliens. And I know that they're a little bit more thinly written, a lot of the, you know, you could call them cliches in a sense, but I can name you, and this is something that I think is unique to the first two films, I can name you every single character on screen. And when can you do that with an ensemble piece, usually, a Hollywood ensemble piece? I know everybody's name.
I'm glad that you brought that up, because that was going to be my next question for you, was that you and I, when we're speaking, just the two of us, you have often said that this is your favorite cast out of all of the Alien movies. And I don't know, I would lean a little bit more towards the Alien movies, the first Alien, when it comes to cast, just because I really like those engineers or whatever you would want to call them. But in this one, you can't deny these personalities. These are much bigger personalities and much sometimes funnier or action-oriented or I don't want to say much more interesting, but much more dynamic in certain ways. And you have Paul Reiser, who does a fantastic job, Michael Biehn, Lance Henriksen. I mean, you can't get much better than Lance Henriksen.
And I extend this to the first film as well, where, you know, we can name all the, you know, Ripley, Parker, Ash, Dallas, Lambert, Brett. I mean, but and it's the same with this film. Like, I can pay attention to everybody on screen because they make everyone stand out, but not in a bad way. Everyone is sort of unique, whether it's a memorable line or a trait about them or whatever. But, you know, Ripley, Hudson, Hicks, Vasquez, Gorman, Burke, Appone, Drake, you know? So it just, yeah. They all just stand out to me, and they're so wonderful. And like I said, to you, I think it was on another show, what draws me to this more, and yes, it's corny, but this is the more quotable film. Not that I'm saying that the dialogue from the first film isn't quotable, but everybody knows a lot of the lines from this film. I mean, I even just watching it always brings a smile to my face, certain things like, you know, hey Vasquez, anyone ever mistake you for a man? No, have you?
As quotable as Bill Paxton is in this movie, and I like Bill Paxton, this has to be one of his worst action movies of all time.
Oh, no, I completely disagree, because he serves the same role that Lambert serves in the first one. And I think it's actually one of the most genuinely acted characters in this film, because you need the person that's scared out of their mind, and whether or not you go with however big they're playing it is one thing, but it's acted correctly. And I like seeing just someone, and I like his shift of character, because you're going in there, hey Ripley, don't worry, my team of absolute badasses will protect you, you have nothing to worry about, we got, you know, we got nukes, we got knives and all that sort of, you know, macho crap. And then, you know, you immediately switched that around when they had their first encounter with the horde of aliens. And I just love seeing how that happens. And you know, Ripley finally has to hammer down hard on him. And, you know, I just love this little girl survived, you know, weeks with no weapons and no training. Well, why don't you put her in charge? So I love that character. Hudson is one of my favorite characters in this whole film. And I especially feel what I like about this is that the group of Colonial Marines, while I could name every single one of them when they're at the beginning, what I like about them is the first alien encounter takes out about half of them, and it leaves you with a core group of who you're going to follow for this film. And the movie does a great job, in my opinion, of making you care about every single one of them in the same way that first film did, where when somebody dies, it's a notable, you feel that they're gone. You notice that they're gone. It's a notable absence, and it hurts. And I like that.
I think my favorite death scene was probably be Vasquez in the Vince with, I can't remember.
You always were an asshole, Gorman.
yeah, Gorman, yeah, with the lieutenant, when they're holding the grenade together, and then that explodes. For some reason, those kind of deaths always get to me. Like, when it's two people who are stuck together, and they know that they're going to die, and so they hold hands, or they hold each other. That always gets to me. I don't care how sci-fi it is, or how ridiculous it can be. That always gets to me, when two people accept their fate together.
And what I like about that, too, is that she couldn't stand him throughout the whole movie. And yet, he's the person that she's going to die with in the end.
Now, one thing that I thought was really interesting about this film, now that we've talked about the film overall and the kind of the feeling and the verve, is the behind the scenes. The most interesting thing behind the scenes for me was this was filmed mostly at Pinewood Studios in England. This is a very famous studio that is that Star Wars Episode 7 is being filmed at right now, and also the entire Harry Potter series was filmed at Pinewood as well.
In fact, the first three Alien films were filmed at Pinewood.
That's right. And so this was filmed in, so it's in England, and so James Cameron is an American. Ridley Scott was not. And James Cameron had a very hard time working with a British crew. The British work ethic or work dynamic is very different from the American dynamic when it comes to film, when it comes to cinema and production work and things like that. I couldn't tell you if that's the same today, but it definitely was evident back then in the 80s. And, you know, the Brits, they would have tea time. They would start later and they would leave a little bit later.
Very lackadaisical from an American point of view.
Yes, from an American point of view. Now, I'm not saying it's better. I'm not saying it's worse. I'm just saying it's different. And the Americans sometimes have been criticized very much because we take the least amount of vacations and the least amount of breaks. And it can wear down our psyche. And so James Cameron just could not handle this because time equals money on a set. You are always under the gun. And so he was losing it. He just couldn't handle having this crew and who were just, like you said, so lackadaisical. And so it was just this everyday battle trying to get the movie done.
And not only that, not only was it hard for him, it's hard for him because he's James Cameron. And for those of you who don't know, James Cameron does have a bit of a reputation. He's a control freak. He likes to do everything in his films. He likes to write them. He likes to produce them. He is in control. When you're watching a James Cameron film, it is James Cameron through and through. And when he's not getting that support from that he thinks he needs from his staff, it was just that much more irritating because he's that much more on top of things in his films than most directors are in their own films.
Yes, and now that James Cameron is James Cameron, because back in the 80s, I mean, yeah, he had Terminator under his belt, but he wasn't the behemoth that he is today with Titanic and Avatar under his belt. There was an actual walkout on set where he fired the director of photography, and so people were just like, okay, well, if you're going to fire Dick Bush, then we're going to walk out. He had to coax other people from coming back so that he could finish the film, because this guy didn't want to light the way that the director wanted, and so James Cameron's like, okay, well, then you're gone, which is very common on a film set. I've seen it happen. It's just, I've seen people fired for not knowing how to wrap cords the right way. And if you clash with the director, like sometimes if you have a relationship, you can disagree, but he still has the right not to listen to you, or she has the right not to listen to you. And Dick Bush apparently just pushed it too far and he was let go. And now you would never do that on a James Cameron set because James Cameron is James Cameron.
Exactly.
This design wise, this is a James Cameron film. Like you said, like the design is you get this feeling that you get with the rest of his movies. Like if you watch Avatar, you see so much influence from Aliens. It's ridiculous.
To the point where the main antagonist of this film, that film, who's played by Stephen Lang, was originally going to be offered to Michael Biehn, but specifically James Cameron did not want him in the film because Sigourney Weaver was already in the film and he didn't want too much of aliens sneaking into the film, so it went to Stephen Lang instead. The other thing I would like to talk about on this film before we move on is we gave props to H.R. Giger for his brilliant work on the original Alien and designing the original creature. I also want to give a special shout out on this film to Stan Winston for not only updating what was on the original design, but he is the one who gave us the Alien Queen.
I'm so glad that you brought that up because I wasn't going to talk about it because it just slipped my mind, but I'm looking at a picture of her right now, and she is a work of art. And sadly, Stan Winston as well is no longer with us, and he was a...
And talk about a legend. I mean, this is the guy who gave us the Jurassic Park dinosaurs as well, and the Terminator.
And the Terminator, yes. And so many other creatures. He had his own workshop, and so many great, iconic aliens and monsters has come out of his workshop. And the Alien Queen, watch the Blu-rays or watch the behind-the-scenes features. When you watch, like, the editors were amazing on this film. And when you watch the raw footage of the Queen, I don't know if I would have had the vision that James Cameron did as a director, because watching the raw footage, you're like, this is going to suck. This is going to look stupid. This doesn't look threatening. This doesn't look real. This does not look convincing at all. But the way that it's cut together, the lighting that they use, the smoke that they use, and the angles all make it look fearsome and real and believable.
Not only that, but the way that the Queen is first introduced on screen, where it's the slow panning shot. You see they're in a room surrounded. They walk into a room and they notice that they're surrounded by eggs. And then all of a sudden you see this little gross thing deposit an egg over there, and you follow it up the ovipositor, you go, you know, it's this huge thing, and then finally it arrives at the main body and the face comes out, and you have that epic stare down between Ripley and the Alien Queen, and it's fantastic. It's one of my favorite, like, monster reveals of all time in any film.
Yeah, it's a worth watching it just for that. Well, we have to move along because we've been talking for an hour and we have two more films to talk about, and I feel like we're going to talk about Alien 3 a little bit less than the first two, because it's definitely the weaker of the first three, and Alien Resurrection I want to talk about very little. But Alien 3, you and I have very different feelings about this movie. Now, so the first Alien came out in 1978. 79. Alien came out in 79, Aliens in 86, and Alien 3... came out in 1992. Again, a big gap in between.
Not for lack of trying, though. This film, what I will say is that this film has the most interesting production history of all the four films. Fox wanted this out in 1988 because Aliens was a massive hit, and it, like, it brought it back to the mainstream. It was like one of the, I think it was one of the top grossing films of all that time that year.
That year, and also even today, it's one of the most top-grossing rated R films of all time.
So they wanted a sequel immediately. They knew they had a franchise on their hands. But why don't we tell them a little bit about what went on in Alien 3?
Well, it's kind of hard because it just didn't get off the ground in 87 to 89. They tried for 3 years to get it to go, but they just couldn't get the script right. They couldn't get the green light. It just was not pulling together. And then you had it try to start up again with Vincent Ward, and that didn't work. And then you had a script from Walter Hill and David Giler, and that script, when that was made, was the genesis of Alien 3. But the script we got that actually got made is very different from the original script from Hill and Giller. When I was going to film school, my roommates at the time were going to a different film school, and one of my friends, he had to study the script revisions of Alien 3 because there were so many. It had a remarkable amount of script revisions. Now, on any film, you have a lot of revisions and a lot of versions.
To the point, but yeah, I imagine you have many revisions, but never to the point where, from what I understand on this film, script changes were being made as the thing was filming. Like, actors were handed new scripts as they were getting ready to shoot.
Well, that actually isn't that uncommon, because that happens on a lot of sets, but this wasn't just like line changes or even scene changes. This was complete restructuring of a script where it would just get ridiculous. Like, this movie was in such development hell and shooting hell that they study it as an epic failure in classes on what not to do and how not to screw with a movie. And Fincher had such a Fincher came from a background of music videos, and this was his first film. Now, he did a lot of music videos very successfully. He wanted to take this on, and, like, this is when he was young and very much, you know, damn the man, damn the system, and, like, I'm not gonna be a part of the Hollywood system and everything like that. And so he very much was pissed at Fox interference with the process. Like, he did not make any how do I put this? He was not scared to tell Fox to go screw themselves during the filming process.
To the point where now he doesn't even acknowledge this is his film, and quite famously, in these extra edition Blu-ray sets and DVD sets, he's the one director to not come back and give a director's cut because he does not put his stamp on this film at all.
Yeah, if he could have put Alan Smithy as the director, he would have.
I have to imagine it's for a very different reason, though, that Fox was interfering, because the script, if you could call it a script, because it's continually being changed, but the story that Fincher was shooting has to be so against what Fox wanted, because I can only imagine, especially after the success of Aliens, that Fox thinks, franchise. We've got another franchise on our hand. Star Wars is over at this point, but we got this new sci-fi franchise that we could spin off and do all sorts of things with. This is not, whatever you think of Alien 3, it's not the movie to launch a franchise with. It's the movie to end a franchise with.
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, we could go on and on about how development, in development, it was horrible, and the production was horrible, and there were so many problems. And I feel like the movie suffered. It did. I mean, a lot of people don't like this movie. Now, I like this movie, but tonally, this is a very different movie. Now, I like the tone. I like how dark it is. I like how dreary it is, because I feel like it would have been easy to make Aliens Part 2. It would have been easy to make another war film or another action film, but this is not a film like Alien. This is not a film like Aliens. This is very different, and I appreciate that. And I love that you can see early Fincher in this. Like, when you watch it, you're like, this is clearly a Fincher movie, even before Fincher was Fincher.
I agree. And look, I have a very checkered history with this film. I hate it, but I don't. Because there are things about it that I can appreciate, and I can understand that it went through a very troubled history.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate that it's different than Aliens, but the story progresses to a place that I wish it wouldn't have. Does that make any sense? I mean, this is not where I wanted to see these characters go. It's just because I was so attached, especially to not only Ripley, but the three other survivors from Aliens, that, spoiler alert, when they're killed off screen, really, in the first 5 minutes of this film, that's really hard for me to swallow. I mean, that is a bitter, bitter pill, because you're basically washing away that last film to get Ripley isolated again. And I kind of feel, I know why they did it, but at the same time, I don't know, that whole climax of that last film was her going back into the hive to get Newt back. And just conquering her fears, she was going to get this girl back. If nothing else, if she died, it didn't matter. She was going to save this little girl. Considering what happens to her and the rest of the cast in Alien 3, I don't know. I can't put it in any other words. I kind of feel emotionally robbed of the climax of the last film.
You know, it's funny that, you know, like when you and I were talking about this, you know, it never really dawned on me that way, just because this is how the movie is. Like, this is the cast that we have, and this is the story that we get, and that's just how it is. But when you describe that to me, it's very true. You're very right. I'm like, yeah, we did kind of get robbed of that.
Not only that, but like the way this film goes so dark, and I like darkness, don't get me wrong, but to not only kill off these characters, but we get to see Newt dissected very grisly, and that has some of the I'm going to compliment the Foley work on that. When they're cracking her chest open, it is ugly, but it is very, very difficult to watch. It's me being such a fan of that cast of that last film.
It's hard. It's there's so much that they put you through in Alien, because we see an attempted rape scene.
Oh, man. See, I don't like that at all. I mean...
Oh, well, no, I'm not listing things I like here. I'm talking about things that are rough to watch. I mean, we see Michael Biehn and these people, we see images of them, or that's also another story where originally you would see Michael Biehn's likeness and then a chest burster, and then he's like, no, you're going to have to pay me for that privilege, and then they had to cut him out.
Well, I'm going to come to his defense, because rightly so, you would think that perhaps they would continue that character after that second movie, and just to be written off like that, like, what? I'm not even going to get to be in this film? Screw you, you know.
Did you watch the interviews with him about Alien 3?
I did, and I'm totally with him. I would have done the same thing.
I was not, because like for some, he was giving off this vibe to me where I'm like, oh, you're kind of a jackass.
No, I think the filmmakers were kind of like, I think the filmmakers treated his character very badly, because it seems to me that you know, they didn't even give a second thought. Well, screw him, we'll just kill him off. There, you know, that's really disrespectful to that character, I would say. And I feel like I would understand feeling disrespected that way. So I was with him. I would want money too.
I don't know. I guess I can see your perspective, but like in the interview, I was just kind of like, this feels a little self-righteous. But with what you said about not getting these characters, yeah, I really loved the Michael Biehn and Sigourney Weaver dynamic. I loved it, and I would have loved to have seen it in the third one. But it definitely didn't fit in the story that they were trying to tell.
I know they didn't, but really, I just... Not only that, the biggest flaw in this thing for me is that, save for a few characters like Charles S. Dutton and Charles Dance, this movie suffers from what the first two films excelled at very well. I don't know who's who. And when people die, I was like, who died? You know what I mean? Like, it's just, I can't get emotionally invested in these people. A, they all look the same. They all sound the same. And B, they're all murderers and rapists and horrible people that, like, I'm supposed to feel bad when you die? You know, it just, that just bothered me. And honestly, too, Ripley is kind of, I love strong female protagonists, and she's right up there, probably is like my number one. She's like a hero to me. And just to see, I know why she goes through what she goes through in this film, but to see her just utterly give up to the point where she doesn't even care about killing the alien anymore. She wants to die halfway through the film. That's really not where I wanted to see this character end up.
And see, it's so funny because I never even really thought about that until you brought it up. It's kind of like Indiana Jones in Raiders of the Lost Ark. Nothing he does matters in that movie. Seriously, watch Raiders again and think about what influence this character actually has on the progression of the plot. He's basically along for the ride with the audience, where nothing he does actually continues success or achieves anything. And you brought that up to me about Ripley in Alien 3. She doesn't really do anything. She doesn't really make too much happen, at least not until the very, very end.
No, and even at the end, she's not doing that much. She's ready to check out, like, before the climax even starts.
And you're absolutely right, and it's just something that I never really thought about. And I can't argue with you about this, because you're right. But I still enjoy this movie. And one of the things that made me really enjoy this film, and I know this might be a minor thing for some people, but that's Elliot Goldenthal's score.
Okay, I'm glad you brought this up, because this is one of the positives I have about this film. I love this score. The score is great.
Have you ever seen Interview with a Vampire? It was one of my favorite movies growing up, and one of the best things about that movie is the score, and he did that one. And it's so haunting.
He also did the score. I know it's not one of your favorite films, but he also did the score for Batman Forever. And there's this...
I love the music of that one.
And there's the scene where... I hate the scene where Ripley gets raped, but the music in that scene is very distinctive. It's like this guitar riff.
It's an attempted rape.
It almost happens. Like, she wouldn't have gotten out of it had Charles S. Dutton not shown up. And that kind of bothered me. But, it's like this guitar riff sort of music. And if you go back and watch Batman Forever, he uses the same music when Robin is with the Neon Gang in that film.
That's right. I thought I recognized that. That's so right. Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, like he got an Oscar nomination for Interview with the Vampire and also an Oscar nomination for Michael Collins. And then he developed a relationship, a professional relationship with Julie Taymor, and did the scores for all of her films. And so I definitely... Like, watch Alien 3 for the score, Interview with a Vampire, Michael Collins, Heat, Batman Forever, and definitely Titus. Those are some of his best scores of all time.
I will say one more positive, so I don't sound like a complete negative on this film. This film does contain one of my most favorite moments, and it's the moment that they used for all the promotional material. Ripley against the wall, face-to-face with the alien snarling in her face. That is a great moment, and I just wish it was in a better story, but I love that moment.
Yes, that is, and they use that in all the promotional materials, and it's a very, very cool moment where you realize something's wrong, where, like, why did the alien leave me alone? And I love how each xenomorph is a little bit different from each movie, because it's just cool. Like this one, I mean, depending on what version you watch, it either comes out of a dog or it comes out of a bowl. And one thing of behind the scenes, besides just the development that to coincide with our theme, just a little bit from each movie, one thing that I thought was cool was they had to go back for reshoots on this movie. And that's very common on a film. And an actor sign an agreement that, okay, even though we're done with the film, you're contractually obligated to go back and do reshoots. But the thing is, Sigourney Weaver shaved her head for this role. She actually shaved her head. Not too many people do that. I know that what's her name from Doctor Who did it for Guardians of the Galaxy recently, and Charlize Theron did it for the next Mad Max movie. Now, Sigourney Weaver did that, and she put it in her contract that if they had to do reshoots and it was past a certain time, that they'd have to pay her an obscene amount of money. And I cannot remember off the top of my head how much.
I think
money
it was like $5,000 or something like that, but or $50,000.
No. It was a lot more than $5,000.
It had a five in it. That's all I remember.
Yeah, no, it was a lot of money, enough to make people twinge a little bit. Like, and she knew what she was doing, and she was doing something really smart. Like, if you're gonna make me shave my head again, that's gonna hurt me for getting roles in the future, or it's going to make it difficult.
Well, not only that, but she had a very young daughter at the time, and her daughter was afraid of her with the bald head.
Yeah, and that's something to take into account. And so what they did was, like, okay, if you make me shave my head, you're going to have to give me this amount of money. And so what they did was, they like, okay, well, we'll make her a bald cap, but they had to make the bald cap look convincing and look like how she looked in previous shots of the film. And so they had to hand make it with every single strand of hair, and the bald cap was just a little bit less expensive than what she was old if she shaved her head, but it was a net gain. And I wish I could give you some figures right here, but just know that once we go to the final scene where they're in the with all the smelting or whatever it's called, I don't know the word. The iron melting. During that scene, whenever you see that, she's wearing a bald cap, and it's a very good one.
It is a very good one. And I have my problems with this movie, and it is still my least favorite, but there are things about it that I can appreciate. It's just, it's a matter of, this is not where I wanted these characters to go. And maybe that's very selfish of me. Maybe I should consider where it would be best for the story, but it just seems to me that just not a path that I wanted to travel down. That's all.
Well, speaking of paths that we don't want to travel down, let's talk about Alien Resurrection. It came out in 1997, which is, again, a long time after 1992. So each sequel came out years and years after its predecessor came out. And this could be the biggest piece of crap I've ever seen. And I still don't understand how Alien 3 can be your least favorite of the series. This is horrible.
Let me nip this in the bud right now. You and I are not that far apart in our opinion of this film. It's garbage. Like, I acknowledge that this film is garbage, and I know that this thing went through a hell of a writing process. Joss Whedon was initially involved in this, but his script was rewritten to hell, and this is not what he originally wrote.
Okay, I was going to say, I was like, I never knew the backstory on that, and I want to read a quote real quick from Joss Whedon, where, like, when I see Joss Whedon's name, I was like, oh, this is going to be good, because I'm a big fan. He wrote Toy Story, he did The Avengers, he did Buffy, Angel, Firefly, and this is what Joss Whedon had to say about the final product. It wasn't a question of doing everything differently, although they changed the ending. It was mostly a matter of doing everything wrong. They said the lines, mostly, but they said them all wrong, and they cast it wrong, and they designed it wrong, and they scored it wrong. They did everything wrong that they could possibly do. There's actually a fascinating lesson in filmmaking, because everything that they did reflects back to the script or looks like something from the script, and people assume that if I hated it, then they'd change the script. But it wasn't so much that they changed the script, it's that they just executed it in such a ghastly fashion as to render it almost unwatchable. Joss Whedon and I are of the same ilk when it comes to this movie.
Yes, and I'm not saying I'm not, okay? I don't want you to hear that I think that this, by any stretch of the imagination, that this is a good film. I don't think that this is a good film. The Alien series ends for me with aliens. I would much rather have that be the ending and just not know where it goes from there. Given Alien 3 happening, though, where that just pretty much ends the franchise as a whole, to me, that film broke the Alien series for me. I just kind of wasn't into it after that. I didn't have high hopes for this film. And basically all I wanted was enjoyable garbage. And for me, that's exactly what this film gave me, was garbage that's enjoyable. And it, like if I had a list of guilty pleasure films, this would probably be, mm-hmm. like in my top five. And when you say guilty pleasure, you're acknowledging that a film is bad. So, the things that this does right for me, though, compared to Alien 3, and I think, you know, explaining my reasoning behind why I don't care for Alien 3 so much kind of highlights why I could go with this one a little bit more. I know who the characters are. I can separate. They're not as distinct as the first two, but I know who people are. They may not be characters that you really like, and they may not be casted correctly, and I fully acknowledge that, but I know who everybody is. And Ripley isn't really Ripley in this movie, but she's back to being a warrior, which I like.
Yeah, but the thing is, even though the thing that made Ripley interesting as a woman of power, or a warrior, as you put it, was that she was an average person
who, yes.
like her, who stood up when times got tough. Like she wasn't a hero, but she wasn't a coward either. In this one, she's literally a clone of the former Ellen Ripley and has the alien DNA
right.
mixed in with her.
That's a problem. I'm not saying that's not a problem. I just like the way she... I like that she's more of an active character. Can I put it that way? In Alien 3, she's very passive.
Yes. I can give you that. Like, it is interesting to see her much more active in the story and with her cause and effect and everything like that. Yes, I can agree with that. But just the entire setting, that it's set 200 years after Alien 3. She's a clone.
If I were writing this, I would have just had Alien 3 be a dream, for quite frankly, because where do you go from Alien 3? Like, they left them nothing. So, you know, to me, it's kind of doomed to begin with, because it's like, where do you go from here?
For those of you who haven't seen it, like, I can't really say watch it, but the thing is that my wife had never seen this until we got the entire set, and I said, I was like, okay, we're going to watch Alien Resurrection, and then that's it. Like, we're not going to watch it again. And she's like, well, what if I like it? I was like, you're not going to like it. And so she watches it, and she's like, yeah, you're right. I never need to see that again. This is what Roger Ebert said about it. There is not a single shot in the movie to fill one with wonder.
I agree with that.
I have to agree with that. Yeah, there's nothing good about this
and
film.
Yet if I just want some like I said, enjoyable garbage, that's how I classify this film. If I want to watch some like, for example, I had a sleepover with like a friend of mine when I was like 13, and we put this on for kicks and giggles, and we both had a good time with it. You know what I mean? It's that kind of film. It don't watch this to watch a good film. Watch it if you're a fan of C movies, you know what I mean? Because I can go with that sort of thing. It's a combination of identifiable characters, some fun personalities. Like, this is the film that introduced me to Ron Perlman, and I really enjoyed him in this film. But, and Ripley being an active character, which is how I see Ripley in the first two films. And I think that it's a combination of those elements that gets me through Alien Resurrection. I may watch it like once a year or something, if that. Mm-hmm. But it's nowhere, I know where, I don't watch it nearly as much as I watch the first two films.
All right. Well, that was our retrospective on the Alien films. One quick question before we sign off. Would you want an Alien 5 at all? Do you think it should be done with Alien Resurrection? Do you think there should be an Alien 5? Or do you think there should be a reboot, since those are very popular right now?
I don't know how you do an Alien 5 with taking Alien Resurrection to account. Now, I could see them doing an Alien 5 in the style of doing a Halloween H2O, where it ignores certain sequels, Resurrection being one of them, and just... I would even be okay with ignoring Alien 3. But if you want to start with Alien 3, you know, go with a different path. Do something else. I'd be okay with that sort of thing. As far as a reboot's concerned, I don't know. Because I hate being the person that's closed-minded. You know what I mean? Like, I hate the whole reboot suck mentality, because I want to give everything a fair chance. But I don't know how you reboot it, and I would be hesitant to see how it would be rebooted. If it's being rebooted, I hope it's with someone who appreciates the first film. I'll just put it that way.
This may be an unpopular opinion, but I think in Alien reboot, I might be on board for that one, because I'm of the mind
I would go see it.
Yeah, like, I'm of the mind that a reboot does not erase the original. It may not always be best, it may not always be the smartest move, but it doesn't mean you still can't go back and enjoy Alien, Aliens, Alien 3, or Alien Resurrection if that's your thing. And I don't know, I could feel it working. I mean, I think if they stay true to the feeling of Alien or Aliens and not make it just another shoot 'em up bang bang where like people's guts were being spilled out, like, yeah, I could see it if they went towards that original feeling, I'd be okay with it. A sequel, I don't know how they would do it. I think I'd be more of a fan of a reboot than a sequel, but that is just my opinion. Now, we'd love to hear your guys' opinion. So please go to thenerdparty.com and email us from there, or the email address is contact@thenerdparty.com, or find us on Twitter. I'm @TheInsaneRobin.
And I'm @MHansen0207, H-A-N-S-E-N.
And please, please write us. Let us know what you think about the show. Give us some topic ideas. Give us some things that you want us to talk about or you want to hear about. And also, please subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you listen to us and give us a review. If you give us a 5-star review, we'll mention you on the podcast. More people who give us reviews, more people who subscribe, the more people will notice and the more episodes we can do. And so thank you so much. I'm Tristan Riddell.
And I'm Matt Hansen.
And this has been The Nerd Party.
Coming up next week.
Next.
Michael Audrey Myers shall be tried as an adult for the murder of his sister, Judith Margaret Myers.
You fooled them, haven't you, Mike? But not me.
It's a holiday you'll remember forever.
Halloween night is when people play tricks on each other.
What about the boogeyman?
Death has come to your little town, Sheriff.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Pod.
Shh. It's time to say goodnight to inefficient night storage heaters. Bulky, unattractive, with no precise control, leaving you boiling in the morning and rather chilly at night. So tune in to Fisher Future Heat, home heating systems that give you a steady, controllable supply of heat 24 hours a day. Search Fisher Future Heat today. Fisher Future Heat. The future is electric.